You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by United Auto Workers Local 249 and Teamsters Joint Council 56. United Auto Workers Local 249 members building the best Ford trucks and vans in the world. Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions representing 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We are proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. And the Heartland Labor Forum is proud and appreciative of the support we get from our local unions and specifically from tonight's underwriters. On tonight's show, the attack on public education has become an onslaught, starting from the heights of the American Legislative Exchange Council and subverting institutions from kindergarten through higher ed, with the myth that public is bad and a failure. Hear about it, the corporate takeover of our schools, tonight on the show. It's called From Public to Charter to Virtual, What's Next for the Schools? In the news, fast food workers, home care and retail workers, and adjunct professors strike and demonstrate against poverty wages. And fast-track agreement in Congress, get ready for a huge debate. Our feature at the end of the show will be Know Your Rights with attorney Angie Williams, who's going to be talking about how they're tampering with the rights of LGBT people in Jefferson City. Now for the news.
Hi, today's April 16th. Welcome to the news from our side. On Wednesday, fast food workers around the nation struck again. They were joined by home healthcare workers, retail workers, and adjunct professors. Here in Kansas City, there were support actions all day starting at 6 a.m. at a McDonald's. At noon, about 150 demonstrators marched down Main Street from Westport Road to visit the disability rights organization The Whole Person, because it is blocking the home care workers and employees from unionizing. On the way, Michael Enriquez, lead organizer for the Workers' Organizing Committee, was detained by police, who apparently were out to interrogate him about the march route for the afternoon. He was released after a few hours. Meanwhile, cops lined Main Street looking very militarized. One officer wore a badge proclaiming himself to be a member of the KCMO sniper unit. In the afternoon, a delegation of 15 adjunct faculty and citizen supporters dropped in on Rockhurst President Reverend Thomas B. Curran, who was too busy to see them but did accept a huge blow-up petition signed by hundreds of adjunct professors and supporters, asking the university to live up to its Jesuit values. Then, at 5 p.m., a huge rally took place at Tice Park opposite the Nelson Art Gallery. Estimates ranged from hundreds to 1,000. Mayor Sly James spoke, endorsing higher wages. Fast food workers, union leaders, and religious leaders spoke too. Here's Reverend Rodney Williams, who spoke just before the march.
Newsflash! The cry is already against you.
Yes, it is.
Because 26,000 fast food workers in Kansas City are crying against you. 4 million fast food workers across America in 160 cities are crying against you. At least a quarter of American workers are low wage income, Nick people, and they are crying against you. 9 out of 10 home health care jobs are held by women. They and their children are crying out against you. Not only is there words from God against the evil, oppressive CEOs of the nation, But there's a word from God for all of the low-wage workers who have to deal with the oppressive treatment of these billion-dollar corporations. The scripture says, now the just shall live by faith. If any man or woman draw back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him. But you, the workers of the fast food and low-wage movement, you are not who they say you are. You will not draw back into destruction because we believe that we can win. So we march together. We shut down highways together. We shut down stores together. Why? Because we believe that we can win. As long as we stand together with courage, organize successfully, mobilize consistently, and do our part, God will change their hearts.
Yes, he will.
Because we are standing on the truth.
I believe that we will win. We'll win.
The low-wage workers, who are demanding $15 an hour in a union, then marched out of the park, through part of the plaza, and down to UMKC, where they climbed the hill to the new student union and assembled out front. Another spirited rally of over 500 people took place. Adjunct Professor Liz Jacquinot spoke about the careless manner in which universities treat trained teachers. Then a student-slash-low-wage worker capped it all off.
My name is Aliana Hudson. I'm a full-time student here at UMKC, and I study English with an emphasis in creative writing. I work 12 to 15 hours part-time at Pickleman's for minimum wage. I don't make enough with minimum wage to support myself and my own, so my parents help me out. I'm standing for myself and other part-time working students for better wages so we can pay for our education.
The New York Times reports that congressional leaders appeared to have finally come to an agreement on the fast-track bill, which could grease the wheels to pass President Obama's new blockbuster trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The Times says the outcome is definitely in doubt and sure to become one of the toughest legislative battles of his last 19 months in office. The fast-track, or Trade Promotion Authority bill, would give Congress the power to vote on the Trans-Pacific Partnership once it is completed, but would deny lawmakers the chance to amend it. Senator Orrin Hatch, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and Representative Paul D. Ryan of Wisconsin, chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, had to agree to stringent requirements for the trade deal to win over Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, the ranking Democrat on the finance panel. Those requirements include human rights negotiating objective that has never existed in trade agreements, according to lawmakers involved in the talks. The legislation would also make any final trade agreement public for 60 days before the president signs it, and up to 4 months before Congress votes. If the agreement negotiated by the United States Trade Representative fails to meet the objectives laid out by Congress on labor, environment, and human rights standards, a 60-vote majority in the Senate could shut off fast-track trade rules and open the deal to amendments. Representative Dave Reichert said, "We got assurances that the U.S. Trade Representative and the president will be negotiating within the parameters defined by Congress." Even with those concessions, the fight to get trade promotion bill to the president's desk will be difficult and emotional, badly dividing the Democratic Party's labor base and putting Hillary Rodham Clinton in a quandary. Many prominent Democrats have come out against one of the biggest priorities of their president. The AFL-CIO and virtually every major union has vowed to fiercely fight this bill, including a six-figure advertising campaign to pressure 16 selected senators and 36 House members to oppose trade promotion authority. The AFL-CIO announced this on Thursday. The news was read by Jake White, and I'm Molly Madden.
Hey, there's a road to travel. It's not one that's made of gravel.
It's your life that is before you.
Just put your best foot forward. I know that you're feeling awkward.
Just remember where.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. The song you've just heard was the 2012 Educational Week song sung by NSW Public School District in Sydney, Australia. My name is Chris Mann, and my co-host is Lon Swearingen.
Hi, how are you?
Tonight our topic is charter schools versus public schools. How do they compare? And what about virtual schools? Our guests are Carl Peterson, former school board president of the Ferguson-Florissant School District in Missouri, Peg Nicholson, chairperson of Missouri Save Our Schools chapter, and finally, we will have a quick update for walking man Jesse Turner, who's walking 400 miles to protest the overuse of standardized testing and the privatization of public education. As the 2014-2015 school year ends, many parents can become bewildered at school choices. Tonight, we'd like to provide information so that the choices may be easier. Our first guest is Carl Peterson. He is the former president of Ferguson-Florissant School Board in Missouri. Currently, he's a board member of Missouri public school advocates, and he's the communications director for Missouri Save Our Schools chapter. Carl recently authored a paper entitled, Please Save the Children of Ferguson.
The first question is, are there more choices for parents and students today compared to 30 to 40 years ago, and are these changes necessarily positive?
Well, I think that there are more changes because, you know, some of the charter schools work as magnet schools, or the magnet schools are started by the school districts themselves. So you do have schools that are totally language immersion, or they're arts-oriented, or they're for gifted children. So that does give a more of a choice. The question is, America has always decided that they would like to have all of their kids together, especially after 1975, where all the kids were incorporated through the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And we decided that we would have all of these kids in our classroom because that's the way our society was. So in separating out some of the students, we lose some of that. And yes, maybe it's better for a particular student to be in there, but then that is what our school system has been all about after all these years, too.
Carl, could you tell us the actual definition of charter versus public and private schools? How do they differentiate?
Charter schools are schools that the state actually supports, and that they are, I don't know what the technical wording of it is, but they are charter public schools in which, in the state of Missouri, they have to be chartered by a university. Although there is a bill in that's moving through the legislature that would do that so that the school district itself could start a charter school, but they are public schools that are run by private entities, whether it's just an individual that's running that, or Edison Educational or some other larger, actually, public sort of corporation that runs them, whereas a private school is exactly that, is a private school, and they are separate. They don't get public money, with the exception private schools and parochial schools are eligible for aid to disabled children and gifted children, and that all the preschool needs can be met by public schools, but charter schools are actually public schools.
For listening parents, how is the success of a school measured? What is the best way to measure the integrity of a school district?
Well, you know, there, we can take what the state defines it by. The state has a measurement system that they call MSEP-5. It has some acronym for just the progress that's shown by each school. And what there shows is what the test scores are for that school, how much improvement the test scores have made, how much, or what is the percentage of kids' attendance, what is their graduation percentage, how many are going on to college, what their ACT scores is, and they sort of lump it all together. I think there's 140 points that the state has, and as long as you get 75% of those points, you are accredited as a good school. And the problem with that is you can have a school that is, say, in the interior of Kansas City who may only be getting a 70 grade out of the 140, yet those teachers are doing an extremely good job compared to for the students that are in that district, as compared to one that may be in the suburbs that has a lot of parents who are college graduates and who have good incomes, and the teachers there may not be getting as good doing a good job, even though their scores are higher. So it's very, very difficult to measure what school is really doing a good job without knowing, you know, what the student population looks like. So, yeah, it's really tough to actually say this school is doing better than another school without really taking into consideration how many of the gifted children does it have, what is the social economic background the kids are coming from, and whether or not there's a tremendous amount of poverty and single parents in that district too, because the school may be doing much, much better. That's in an area that's very, very difficult to define.
So how long have charters been in existence, and what's the track record of charter schools?
I just looked that up, and I knew that the charter schools here in Missouri had started in 1999. That was when the state passed laws, and they had been actually Albert Schenker, the longtime president of the American Federation of Teachers, suggested them. I think it goes back into the 80s, but for Missouri, it started in 1999, and I just looked at some data that I got from the division, or I'm sorry, the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, and they started 39 charter schools in the period, first 10 years from 1999 to 2009 in Missouri, and 15 of those failed. So that's 40% of the charter schools that were started failed. There are several more that are in a state of flux. There are several more that need to be closed down right now. They have not done well. Even right now, of the ones that are open, about 40% of them would be getting unaccredited ratings if we accredited by schools right now, which we, in the coming years, we will be, but they have not done well.
What is the effect of charterization on public education?
Here's the effect that I think it is. It has shown no great improvement in education. Stanford did a study back in 2009, and actually it was done by a group out there that is very pro-charter, and they found out that only 17% of the charter schools outperformed the local schools, and 37% actually got poorer grades than the local schools, and the rest of them were just very, very close. Here's the problem that I find about it. We know that basically if you're going to improve education, you're going to need to lower the class size, you're going to need to have more preschool, more special needs, and to have after school and summer school tutoring for these kids that are in at-risk schools. And what the legislators are telling themselves is, oh no, we don't need to spend that money because we have these fabulous new schools called charter schools that are going to do a great job because all the public schools are just failing and the teachers are bad and the administrators are bad, and these charter schools will do a great job. That's what they tell themselves so that they don't have to give any more money, and they can make them believe that without this money the charter schools will take over. So it isn't so much whether the charter schools themselves are a good or bad idea. It's just that they put out the false hope that they can save the entire situation without the state of Missouri putting forth any more money. That's my problem with charter schools.
So, and most charter schools are not unionized. What's essentially then, the teachers are at-will employees. What is that, and what effect does that have on the school?
Well, you know, there's always this boogeyman that we have about unionized schools. I'm an old plant manager, and I've dealt with unions in plant situations. I've been a president of a school board, and I've dealt with the unions as teachers. All the union ever asks you to do is to do things in a logical, straightforward manner in terms of dealing with a teacher. You just can't go in there and willy-nilly fire an employee because an employee does something that you didn't like. And all a union does is just go through a certain set of straightforward procedures about how to remove that teacher if you have to, or how to, more preferably, how do you give that teacher help. Yes, you can get by with union or non-union, and charter schools are non-unionized. I think that that's a problem in that I think that teachers need security. I mean, people don't work well under threats. And I think that, that is the people who say, well, let's not have people unionized, in general, like the idea that people work under threat of being fired. I don't think that's good. I don't think that's positive management. I don't think that's the way to run people. I had a guy who was a mentor to me as a plant manager, and he'd been through a lot of different plants, and he said, bad employees, they don't cause you any problem because you know who they are and you know how to get rid of them. He says, good employees are the problem because you're trying to convince them that you're on their side and you want to do what's right for them, and you need to convince the good employees that they are important to getting the job done. And if you can't convince those people that they're important, then you're going to fail. That's exactly what happened to Michelle Rhee when she took over the Washington, D.C. school district. Yes, maybe there were some teachers that need to be fired, but she did it in an arbitrary and capricious way, and she lost the entire staff that she was working with of good teachers. So let's worry about the good teachers, and let's worry about what we can do for them, and stop thinking about how can we get rid of the one or two or three bad teachers there might be, and let's start doing what's right for the good teachers.
What would be your advice to parents regarding school choices for the next school year?
If you're, they, almost none of these charter schools offer any real help if your child is having problems, if he's dyslexic or if he's autistic or if he has any kind of malady. So you certainly would want to do that if your child is having a problem. You have to be very, very aware of who is going to be your teacher at some of these schools. As you know, a lot of these schools will have a lot of Teach for America kids who are fresh out of college. They didn't have a degree in education. They have been given 5 weeks worth of intensive training, and they throw them in front of a class and they say, go to it. My wife has, I think, a good handle on why so many of them are failing. She says, yes, they can go out there and they put forth a lesson plan, just like I do. But then when you look out there at the class and you see that that lesson plan didn't go well, she says, I've got 22 years of experience and a master's degree in education, and I know that I can dip into my tool bag and pull out some different way of teaching it so that my class understands it. But these Teach for America kids, which the charter schools use so many of, they don't have anything else. They have their one shot through, the lessons plan's been written for them, and if that doesn't work, they just look out there and the deer in the headlights, the same as their kids are looking. So yeah, parents, you can look at some of these schools and maybe they look better, and they sort of fudge up the numbers on how they get their test scores up, but you gotta look under the hood because a lot of these people are rigging the numbers so that they look better. For one thing, they'll do is they'll get rid of the kids each year, and then they'll never replace them. Kids will leave for whatever reason, or they'll get thrown out of the charter school, and then they only have sort of the cream of the crop left, so their test scores look good, but realistically, they didn't do any better job than the local school.
I want to diverge a little bit. You wrote a document, Please Save the Children of Ferguson. and yes. I wondered why you wrote that, and where can our listeners key into that and read that document, because I think it's very important.
I got really kind of upset over the last 4 years at the amount of information or misinformation that is being put out by what I call the enemies of education. There are a lot of people out there who, they're not about public education. Milton Friedman, the economics professor and Nobel Prize economist, wrote back in the 50s that the only role of government is to collect money for schools and then give it back in vouchers. That's what these people want. They want a voucher so that their kids who are going to parochial schools or going to private schools can have money from the government for their schools. And they have been putting out bad information after bad information after bad information. I am an engineer, and it's just like chalk on a blackboard screeching away for me to see the data that these people use, the way that they twist it around, that I wrote this document to take a lot of what they have said over the past 10 years and say, look, here's the truth. This is the way they took that number. This is the way they lied about it, lied about whether it's class size or grades or, test scores, graduation rates, whatever they're twisting around, and put it in the way I would do it as an engineer.
Well, and besides, I've had a chance to glimpse your article, and besides coming from an engineer's perspective, you come from a very human perspective about the unfair situation in Ferguson. So, and you provide some history of the whole area there. And so we'll look forward to that. But final question, Carl, what are the great contributions public education makes as a whole to our democracy and our way of life?
As you said, I have somewhat of a unique perspective on it. George Washington, when he defeated Cornwallis at the Battle of Yorktown, he went up to Newburgh, New York, to camp his troops for the next 2 years while the treaty was being signed over or worked on in Paris. And one of the things he did, because he was not able to finish his schooling, he started a school up at Newburgh, New York. And it was, he got money from the Continental Congress and some of his own money and some from the Mid-Hudson Valley. Newburgh, New York is about 90 miles north of New York City. And built a public high school to educate his troops. 166 years after that, I walked across the stage at Newburgh Free Academy to get my high school diploma. So I know what those people thought in Washington's time and Jefferson of public education, that the entire fabric of this country is built upon that education of all of us. And that's the other reason why we don't do what they do in other countries. I lived in England when I was a junior in high school, and the little girl that I knew that was at an inn, she was 10 years old, and she was really, really worried about taking what they call a plus 10 exam there, in which that exam was going to determine what track she took for the rest of her life, whether she was going to go on a college track or going to tech school or general education or even less than that. We don't do that. We don't say that 10-year-old and 12-year-old kids should be marred for life or they're predetermined what they're going to be at age 10 or 11. We deal with all of the children all of the time in all of our classrooms. You'll have a kid with 150 IQ sitting next to a kid who's got an 85 IQ and has dyslexia. It makes our teachers teaching a nightmare. And that's the reason why they need so much more help than they do in these other countries. But that's the way we are. That's who we are. We want to be fair to everybody and give everybody a chance. And that's what public education does. It is the great leveler. A lot of the businessmen that are successful, they didn't come from a lot. And they made their way through because our public school system allows us to go with and educate everybody. We are taking people from Latin America right now. The Hispanic population is growing by leaps and bounds, and they're coming from countries, Latin America and the Caribbean, in which 40% of the people never even go to school. I can't imagine what that's like. It's no wonder those countries aren't doing well when you don't educate, and that's what America is all about. It's about the equal education for everybody.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum on 90.1 KKFI Community Radio, Kansas City. Tonight, Missouri public education experts and advocates are providing information about charter schools and virtual schools. Our next guest is Peg Nicholson. Peg is the chairperson for Missouri Save Our Schools and will provide information about virtual schools.
Basically, one of the main purposes of Save Our Schools is to protect public education from the encroachments of privatization. And virtual schools tend to be the antithesis of that.
And Peg, why are school districts resorting to virtual schools, do you think?
On paper and on the face of it, virtual schools look like they would be cutting edge. Because of the technology, and much less expensive, given that they don't use bricks and mortar buildings, you don't need buses and utilities and gasoline, and of course you don't need so many teachers. Unfortunately, many of the schools that are in place now, the virtual chains, have very high administrative costs, including advertising and lobbying, which is also some of the things that push school districts to going into this. When that's factored in, it's somewhat controversial whether it is a good financial move. Right now in Philadelphia, there's quite a controversy because the district is saying that they really want to cut the virtual schools to save money, since those schools are reimbursed at over $1,000 more per pupil than the public schools. And the virtual schools are trying to argue that that's not true. That it's still more economical, but that's very much doubtful.
In other words, is the funding just what they get from the state as far as taxes, like the public schools? Is that all they need? And are they going to make money off of that?
Well, they get the money that the districts pay them for the software and for the support. They also very often get grants from companies that want to encourage this kind of education. They're for-profit companies, so they can function in terms of getting investors and of course the public schools really can't.
There's something else that I found out, and I'm just curious if I'm right on this, is that if they do this, say in a depressed area, say an urban mm-hmm. school district, they can lend out money and not have to pay taxes. Is that true?
That I'm not certain about, the actually lending out money.
Okay.
They're exempt from a lot of the things that public schools need to do. There was, in St. Louis a couple of years ago, there was a huge recruiting drive by some of the private charters where they had billboards, they had radio commercials, all trying to get their numbers up, but the public school district was prohibited from doing any of that, so it was kind of a major disadvantage, and of course the public district was paying for their publicity through their tuition.
Okay, Peg, who has the choice of attending virtual schools here in Missouri?
I could not find that we currently have full-fledged online schools paid for by the districts in Missouri. I know we don't have K-12 Inc., which is the major funder. There may be some. There are a couple of ways that this comes down. One is that it's basically homeschooling paid for by the district. In other words, they provide the software. In some cases, they also provide the actual computers and the whole support system. And the education actually takes place at home. I was interested looking on the K-12 Inc. website that the way they get around the lack of teachers is they, in effect, deputize the parents as learning coaches, which they cheerfully tell them will take about 5 or 6 hours a day. So having that, you know, many schools have the choice. In some states, and I'm not sure if Missouri is one of them, I know some of this is changing, but the schools can cherry pick. If they don't think someone is doing very well, they just say, we're sorry, this isn't for you. You have to go back to another form of education. And therefore, they're not held accountable for those students they couldn't serve. In general, virtual schooling is good for really highly motivated kids or kids with really highly motivated parents who can spend the 5 to 6 hours making sure that the education is working and have the competency to do that, which is, you know, it's not an easy thing. Most of the support from the company comes in the form of, in effect, a help desk for content, which means you can email your teacher or, in some cases, Skype with them, but there's not one-on-one contact.
Now, do you think there's a future for virtual schools?
In general, I think it looks pretty murky. You know, they're very well marketed, and in theory, it could be a good idea, especially in remote areas, but there have been so many closures, and I think people are becoming less satisfied with it since many kids don't do well with it. One of the things it has been used for in the past is for credit recovery programs where kids are behind. They are set down with a certain number of lessons they need to complete in a certain amount of time. It brings them up to speed. Whether it teaches them what they need to learn is another thing altogether. So I think that may continue more than the full-blown online schooling.
Okay, we talked about the role of the teacher in the virtual school as being really minimal. And
right.
As an educator yourself, Peg, is this a type of school that's really good for students?
I don't believe so, especially when it's done as a whole package. Online courses can be a tool, but you need to have a way for the kids to interact with each other, with actual teachers, to have, you know, not just the information, but also the motivation and socialization that they need. Once you start mitigating the online aspect in those ways, it can function, but you also start losing a lot of the supposed price advantage. And it just becomes probably more expensive than it would be without it.
Would educators feel that we should do with the virtual school? Should we get involved in it at all?
The main way educators can get involved is doing their homework when these things are proposed, being really critical in the sense of analyzing what they're being told, and speaking up. They're incredibly expensive to implement, and it makes it difficult for them to get out of it or improve it after you're committed. It depends a lot on the provider and a lot on the role that they see this is playing in an entire district. But I think it's really important that not only educators but also parents and community members not fall for the newest, most exciting-looking snake oil, which these things can be.
Tune in on Saturday afternoons for Real Local Talk Radio Community Programming. Starting at 3 o'clock p.m., Every Woman with Sharon Lockhart and Amy Bell. 4 o'clock p.m., Urban Connections with Donna Morrow Wolf. 5 o'clock p.m., Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City with M.C. Richardson.
You keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin'. And now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you.
Okay, we're here with Jesse Turner.
That song
who
was
is walking
boots are
man.
Made
He's
for
walking,
walking
from
by Nancy Sinatra. Our final guest tonight, Jesse Turner, is a literacy professor at the University of Connecticut. He is planning a walk from Connecticut to Washington, D.C. This is his second walking trek. Why is he doing this? Because he cares about public education and the overuse and overemphasis of standardized testing and the privatization of public education. We called Jesse to find out about his plans for the 400-mile walk. The walk will culminate in a teacher congress in Washington, D.C. in July.
Okay, we're here with Jesse Turner, who is Walking Man. He's walking from Connecticut to Washington, D.C. this summer. And Jesse, why are you doing this?
I'm walking to Washington, D.C. to protest ICE-based assessment, the Common Core, all this kind of phony nonsense educational reform that seems to be oppressing our children and demoralizing our teachers.
And when do you start this march?
I'll start the march on June 11th from Prompford, Connecticut, a very rural community from a country store. I'll start the walk there because June the 11th is my 60th birthday.
And how many miles do you plan to go each day?
Each day I'll go between 8.5 and 10 miles.
Okay, and when will you arrive in D.C.? And what is there? What will you do once you get there?
Sure. I'll arrive in D.C. on July 24th. I'll arrive at the Holiday Inn right around the corner from the United States Department to the BAT National Congress. So I'm one of the keynote speakers for the opening of the BAT Congress, and I'll also be there because SOS is sponsoring a mock trial that puts education reform, high stakes testing, Common Core, charter schools, the whole deal. That's the only race to the top on trial for educational malpractice. So I'm part of that. I'll be one of the witnesses testifying at that trial.
If teachers want to attend this, how would they find out about the Badass Teachers Conference?
The easiest way to do it would be to hook up on Facebook and type in BATS, B-A-T-S, Teachers Congress, and it will take you and give you the information, the hotel, the dates, and that will help you out there.
Okay, and Jesse, if people want to join your walk, how would they do that?
One way they can join my walk is they can, again, go to Facebook, and there's I have a Facebook group called Children of More Than Test Scores. It's an open group, and there's under the events is a Walking Man event, and they can join the walk. They can find information for the walk. They can contact me through that events page. We also have a walk into D.C. Page that people can like, and again, another place they'll be able to find information.
Okay, Jesse, thank you so much.
Thank you. Our guest tonight, Carl Peterson, Peg Nicholson, and the walking man, Jesse Turner. These individuals have just given information about charter and public schools who care enough to volunteer time and effort for public schools. There have always been public schools, parochial schools, private schools, and in-home schooling. But in the USA, a phenomenon started in 1991 in Minnesota and has been proven at least in Kansas City with a 87 failure rate by those Kansas City charter schools. By the way, funds for those 87% failures could have gone to public schools.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Hey, this is Angie Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. With the Supreme Court getting ready to hear a historic argument on April the 28th about marriage equality. And with everything that's been in the news about Indiana's awful so-called religious freedom law, I thought I'd talk a little bit today about similar laws that are in Missouri and Kansas and some things that Missourians in particular can be watching out for going on in the legislation. Missouri and Kansas right now both have bills that are similar to Indiana's House bill. Missouri's is slightly different because it has to do with universities and it has to do with student groups and student organizations that are religiously based, and the organizations being able to, I suppose, discriminate against LGBT folks and still receive university funding or university recognition that they're student groups. Kansas's bill, on the other hand, is very similar to Indiana's bill. Now, you may have heard in the news that Indiana's bill, after the backlash, they kind of backpedaled a little bit and added in some language saying that this bill is not intended and cannot be used to discriminate against people on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. That helps take the sting out a little bit, but it doesn't do enough in most people's opinion. And that is because, like Missouri, Indiana does not have a statewide ban on discrimination against based on sexual orientation and gender identity in their state anti-discrimination statute. Missouri right now has a proposal to add both sexual orientation and gender identity into their state anti-discrimination statute, and that is called the Missouri Non-Discrimination Act, or MONA, and this is actually a good bill that we would like to see passed. And right now, Missouri has an anti-discrimination statute that forbids discrimination against people based on sex, race, age, disability, and I believe military service. I'm not 100% sure on that. This would add sexual orientation and gender identity into that, making it illegal to discriminate statewide against LGBT folks in areas like employment, housing, and a variety of other and public accommodations. This is very important because right now there are only a few cities in Missouri that have ordinances that specifically include sexual orientation and gender identity in their statute. Kansas City is one, and I believe St. Louis is one. And up until recently, Springfield was one. Unfortunately, in our last round of primary elections, Springfield voters voted to repeal the anti-discrimination law, which is very unfortunate. Springfield did have LGBT protection in their anti-discrimination local ordinance, but that has since been, since by meaning like last Tuesday, repealed in the last round of voter voting in the primaries. Two other bills that you might want to watch as well are the so-called bathroom bills. And these two have both been added to the Missouri calendar. And one of them would make it unlawful, actually, to have a, how do they put it? Because it's very strange to have any type. Basically, it says all bathrooms must be one gender, or you could have a single occupancy bathroom where the only one person can go in at a time, and that could be, you know, gender neutral. But if it is a more than one person bathroom, then it must be designated either male bathroom or female bathroom. Then there is another bill that specifically says that you cannot use any funding, any state revenue, to create a gender-neutral environment in a previously gender-divided environment unless federal or state court orders you to. So I guess that means that if this law were to pass, you couldn't use any kind of state money to create a gender-neutral bathroom. So, like, if there isn't already a single occupancy gender-neutral bathroom, you can't build one, I guess. I don't know. It's very strange. And it seems that maybe that this is just something that I think is pretty obviously hateful, and I mean, I'm a little speechless about this, which just doesn't happen all that often, and I think probably Missouri has bigger things to worry about, and I'm wondering why we are spending time regulating bathroom uses. But that is what they are doing. So I would advise everybody who cares about these issues to maybe give a little perusal at the Missouri House and Senate and see if who you have elected is one of the people that's on board these type of bills. That's all the time we have today. Thank you very much for listening. This is Angie Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Thank you, Kansas City, and be safe.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar, April 16, 2015. National Day of Action Against Fast Track and the TPP. Volunteers needed. Saturday, April 18th, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. The CWA Local 6360 at 6415 Universal Avenue, KCMO. They will be canvassing in Clay County, so call Jeff Hayes at 816-561-6360. Wyandotte County Democratic Breakfast, Saturday, April 18th, 8:15 for breakfast, 9 for speaker. KCK Community College, the bottom floor, Jewel Building, room 2325/26. Speaker will be Mayor Mark Holland. Worker Justice Clinic for Victims of Wage Theft, Monday, April 20th, 5 to 8 p.m., El Centro, 650 Minnesota Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas. Dr. Wes Jackson, President of Land Institute, Solving the 10,000-year-old problem of agriculture, a progress report, Wednesday, April 29th, 6 p.m. for reception, 6:30 for the program. Pearson Auditorium, UMKC, Atterbury Student Success Center, 5,000 Holmes Row, KCMO. Show support for Kansas State Rep. Val Wynn, accused of using the word racist. Next hearing. Thursday, April 30th at 2 p.m., room 141S in Kansas Capitol Building. The hearing is open to the public, so I hope you all give her help. If you want to read more, go to www.heartlandlaborreformcalendar.org.
It's just heartlandlaborreform.org, and thank you, Molly, for doing the calendar. Tune in next week to the show. We'll have a segment of Pioneer Women with an interview with United Auto Worker Local 31's President Vicki Hale, and we're going to be talking about adjunct professors organizing. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman, all of tonight's participants and hosts.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.